At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We are taking a trip way up the Amazon tonight to the Earth's most species-abundant frontier to witness its wonder and its destruction. The deep Amazon has long been the wildest of Wild Wests, a teeming frontier with spiders the size of dinner plates, flying fish, fierce crocs, and screaming jaguars. But it is also home to people struggling to survive off a wilderness that is rapidly disappearing, an ocean of life our generation may be the last to know. Tonight on Point, we're going upriver to the lush and wounded heart of an environment on the edge. But first tonight, we turn to Asia, where relations between China and Japan have turned sharply sour recently over oil rights in the East China Sea and a Japanese history book that has sparked demonstrations in China. Over the weekend, anti-Japanese rallies turned violent when protesters hurled bottles at the Japanese embassy in Beijing. Joining me now is Alexandra Harney, South China correspondent for the Financial Times in Hong Kong. Alexandra, thanks so much for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
Alexandra, I wish you could walk us through the tale of this escalation of the past few weeks. Take us through the step-up.
Sure. Well, what we had is several different events in Japan that sparked a reaction around China, the first of which, I think, was the issue of new textbooks in Japan that some in China believe were glossing over some of the parts of Japan's history with China, in particular in the Second World War. That sparked an internet and text message campaign within China that spread across the country, calling for protests and a boycott of Japanese goods. And that led to demonstrations in some of the cities that are typically not very political here, Guangzhou, Shenzhen, down in the south, and then notably in Beijing, where last weekend people attacked the Japanese embassy and the ambassador's residence.
That demonstration in Beijing was something close to a riot, it would seem.
Well, there was definitely a lot of violence, and as you know, demonstrations are politically very sensitive in China, so the fact that people were allowed to do this and allowed to break windows and protest so openly is quite surprising to a lot of people out here.
Tokyo complained vigorously about that, and now we see Japan saying it's going to go ahead with oil exploration in a disputed area in the East China Sea, China responding to Tokyo, saying that this is a serious provocation. Is this all just still at the level of diplomatic exchange, or do we have a real problem between these two giant Asian neighbors?
Well, I think that is exactly what's being decided right now. There's clearly a lot of bad blood between Japan and China that dates back decades, and we've got an escalating situation that I'm not sure the Chinese government is entirely able to control. Some of the movement, there are more talks of protests this weekend, and again in May. So we'll see continued movement by different student groups and other groups within China, and how China and Japan handle this, given the history between them, will determine how much more serious this gets.
This controversy over Japan's textbooks has a very long history. Of course, Japan colonized, occupied, made war in and on China for decades, culminating in World War II. Much historically recorded atrocity during that time and a real wound to Chinese pride and many, many thousands dead. And Japan on the other side not wanting to play it quite that way in its own textbooks. But we're often told these days that huge economies like Japan and China have so much to gain from each other that this kind of old political history will never boil over. It seems that there's a risk of it actually boiling over here.
Yeah, the prevailing argument until now has always been, cold politics, hot economics. That's the sort of slogan that's used often between Japan and China. And that is, in fact, still the case. We've still got huge amounts of Japanese investment, huge amounts of employment by Japanese firms that are in joint ventures with Chinese companies. And also you have, you know, increasingly strong economic links, trade links. So I don't think that we can say that all of a sudden now Japanese investment has stopped, or that these countries' economic complementarity has disappeared by any means. What is happening, though, is that there is a growing awareness among the Chinese public that they can voice their concerns openly about this. So how public opinion plays into China's decision about how they handle textbook issues, or, you know, for example, Koizumi, the Prime Minister of Japan's visits to Yasukuni Shrine, will be crucial in determining what happens next.
And what about what about the domestic implications, Alexander, of these large demonstrations? They don't often happen in China. The government almost never lets them go forward unless it approves somehow. If the Chinese get used to going out in the streets to yell in anger, what about their anger about disparities between rich and poor there? Many internal tensions in China. Is the Chinese government not playing with fire here?
Well, I think that's exactly the question a lot of people out here are asking. And what's clear is that there are grievances that are being voiced that are not just about Japan. That the concerns about income disparity and the enormous changes that are happening in Chinese society and the economy that aren't benefiting everyone equally will give people grievances that they'd like to voice, and there aren't many places for them to do that. So I think initially, at least, the Chinese government was pleased to have at least some way for people to cool off steam. But I don't think this by any means means that the Chinese government is now allowing more protests to continue. We see lots of other examples where they're cracking down at the same time on other kinds of protests around China.
Though once people are in the streets, who knows where their anger could turn. Alexander Harney, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Alexander Harney, South China correspondent for the Financial Times. She joined me from Hong Kong. For 30 years, biologist David Campbell has been exploring the lush vistas of the far western Amazon. He's traveled hundreds of miles into the rainforest to survey every living plant in a land so rich that an area of less than 50 acres contains three times as many tree species as in all of North America. Along the way, Campbell came to know the people who eke out a living in this remote land where abundance is in jeopardy. He has confronted marvelous and dangerous animals and insects, and he's emerged with a difficult message, that this beauty will end soon, that there is now a dark inevitability, his words, to the fall of this basin of life. This hour on Point, heading upriver, up the Amazon, to a world on the edge. You can join the conversation. After all the eco-cafes and rainforest crunch, do you know what's happening up the Amazon? Do you see the stakes? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is David Campbell, professor of biology at Grinnell College in Iowa. He won the Burroughs Medal and the Penn Martha Albrand Awards, among other distinctions, for his 1993 book, The Crystal Desert, Summers in Antarctica. His latest book is Land of Ghosts, The Braided Lives of People and the Forest in Far Western Amazonia. David Campbell, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
You've got a big, big message here, and I don't think we can fully take it on until we get a sense of the terrain you've covered. I wish you'd put us in this river, place us in this country way, way up the Amazon, 2,800, 2,900 miles. Here you are, heading toward the border of Peru nearly. Put us in that canoe, in your shoes. What's the setting? What's the canoe like? What are your supplies? What's surrounding you as you begin to head off into this far west of the Amazon, David Campbell?
Well, the first thing to consider is what time of year you're there, because the water level fluctuates as much as 45 feet depending on whether it's the wet season or the dry season.
45 feet? That's unbelievable.
45 feet, yes. And this is because of the extreme seasonality of the rainfall. Most of us have this misconception that the Amazon is a place of hyperabundant rain. In fact, most parts of Amazonia have a dry season and a wet season.
Now, in this far west, you're saying even there the rise and fall is so great. So when are you writing about in this book? What time of year?
We're drifting through the river in the low water time, just before the rains come. That's when it's most efficient for us to collect plants, because the trees are dry and we can send materos, these are professional tree climbers, up into the canopy to collect specimens. If it were rainy and the tree trunks were slippery, it would be dangerous for them to do so.
Now paint a visual picture of the map of Brazil, of South America. We know the kind of main huge basin of the Amazon that cuts across most of Brazil, but you're really on the far left, I guess, so the far west of that. How deeply in do you fly before you get into the river itself? How many miles up the river by canoe?
Well, for the particular journey I described in Land of Goats, we flew to the frontier outpost of Cruzeiro do Sul, which means Southern Cross. It is the westernmost city in Brazil. It's actually west of Cusco in Peru. Mm. And from there, we continued farther west to the remote range of low hills, really nubbins, called the Serra Divisor, the dividing range between Peru and Brazil, where we conducted botanical inventories of small plots of tropical forest, identifying, enumerating, and mapping every tree greater than 10 centimeters in diameter on 2-hectare plots.
Who's in the canoe with you as you head upriver, David Campbell?
Well, there are scientists trained in the Western tradition. There are local people, most particularly a man named Dionisio, who is able to translate the local taxonomies into the Western ones. He's absolutely essential. There are river pilots who know the shifting sandbars and how to avoid them, know where the oxbows are dangerous. There are cooks. There are materos, these tree climbers. And there are lots of workers who do various tasks, including clearing paths in the forest, cutting trails. We carry a pharmacopoeia of medicines in anticipation of just about anything that might befall us, from snake bite to malaria.
And those waters and those forests are full of things that could confront you. We're going to go deeper upriver with David Campbell tonight. His new book is Land of Ghosts. Listeners, you can join us. Do you remember the Amazon? Has it faded from your mind along with rainforest crunch? Do you realize, as David Campbell says, this may be the last generation of humans to know what the Amazon was? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're taking a trip up the Amazon tonight, way up to the Earth's most species-abundant frontier, to witness its wonder and its destruction. My guest joining us tonight from WSUI at the University of Iowa's studios, David Campbell. He's professor of biology at Grinnell College, author of the new book Land of Ghosts, The Braided Lives of People and the Forest in Far Western Amazonia. You can join the conversation tonight. Can you picture yourself in a canoe so far up the Amazon you're almost in Peru? And you'll hear about this. When even the locals have forgotten the names of Amazon's effusion of wildlife, can we grasp what is being lost there? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. David Campbell, I want to get soon to the dark inevitability, your words that you're writing about here, of your generation, our generation, being the last to live in this kind of species-rich world. But let us feel first what it's like to be in that world. We'll get into the forest, but first, just when you're on the river, that far up, how does life confront you? What do you see as a biologist? And as you say, you're almost you have to wear many hats here because the life is so abundant. But what's coming at you? Make it material for us.
Well, let's imagine that we're drifting downstream silently with a motor cut. First thing you notice is that there are not many animals visible. That open, clear space above the forest, above the river, is a dangerous spot. Very few birds or insects want to take the risk of crossing it. And so most of your cues as to the animals in the forest come from their voices, or auditory cues. For example, you might hear the yipping of a toucan in the distance, or the forlorn descending flute of a tinamou, or the chipping of a troop of howler monkeys, or their cacophony when they're bellowing their territories, defending their their resource of leaves on which they depend, or the hysterical chatter of a troop of dusky titis. These are things you hear drifting down the forest. You may not see the animals, but you perceive and you sense what's going on with your ears.
You describe your canoe man being very careful about the my pronunciation, I'm not sure, the caiman, the crocodiles, yes, of the Amazon, not to get the canoe between them and the nests of their young.
Yes, the caimans are a relative of the American alligator, and the black caiman, one of the five species that occurs in that region, is one of the largest crocodilians in the world, very dangerous. And when the mother is defending her nest, she becomes extremely territorial. She's actually quite tender toward her babies and will take care of them after they hatch, even help them out of their eggs. But during the nesting time, it's very important to stay away from those nests and stay away from mama, because she'll go after you. And she's as long as the canoe you're in sometimes.
And some
you
fairly
can capsize it.
Some fairly amazing animals once you're off the boat, off the water. I was particularly struck by the wild pigs who travel in enormous, I'm not sure what the word is, packs, herds, flocks, and come after you. Describe those for us, David Campbell.
I guess I'd describe their groups as stenches. They have a powerful body odor, a powerful musk, and you can smell them long before you see them. The animals that I wrote about are white-lipped peccaries. They're New World pigs. And they are able to go in bands that literally number hundreds. The trouble with them is that even though each one's only about the size of a Cocker Spaniel, they are altruistic. And if one is injured or one is shot, they'll defend that animal and come after whatever the aggressor is.
What does a beagle-sized pig do to a man?
Death by slicing. They have very large incisors which close like scissors, and they have an acute knowledge of human anatomy. They actually specialize in slicing the Achilles tendon and knocking a person down. The several times I've encountered big bands that were aggressive, I've had to climb trees and just wait for them to pass. They have no capacity whatsoever to climb trees, so you just have to get about a meter above the ground, hang on for dear life, and wait for them to get bored and move on.
Take us from the animal into the botanical here. That's really what you have gone upriver to focus on, to bring out the samples, to understand what's happening there. What was your mission exactly over all these years? And give us a sense of this unbelievable diversity that you find.
Well, by enumerating all of the individual plants in small plots of forest, we get an idea of how these associations, these hyper-rich associations of species, are able to live together, whether some have affinities for particular microhabitats or terrains, whether they have affinities for particular neighbors, whether they have affinities for particular regimes of soil moisture, et cetera, et cetera. This also gives us information which is extremely valuable in terms of designating priorities for conservation, because until you do one of these inventories, you really don't know if the area has all these species packed into it. And you can compare your data from one particular plot with others and set up a scheme, a triage scheme, basically, whereby you can prioritize the setting aside and conservation of those most diverse spots.
Now, what I understand is you're going back to the same plots trip after trip, year after year, to see how they've progressed. Is that right?
That's right, Tom. That's another dimension of the research. We're trying to see if there is any change in the turnover rate, in the pace at which new individuals replace the old ones in the forest. There's some hypotheses out these days that as greenhouse gases accumulate, as carbon dioxide accumulates in the atmosphere, it may accelerate the turnover rate of the tropical forest trees. And nobody knows what effect that's going to have on the long-term diversity of the place.
David,
you can only measure that kind of change by coming back year after year.
Which is exactly what you've done, measuring and collecting samples. You know it so intimately and so well. You say you came to the river for science, you stayed for the beauty, and we get a sense of that from you. But you just mentioned conservation, and I have to put that up against the kind of overarching message of this book, which would almost make a conservationist despair. You say there's a dark inevitability here. All of this beauty, this refuge of the imagination, not to mention, I would say, all the wildlife, will end soon. In a few years, this forest will succumb to flames, the mediocrity of monocultures, nationalistic paranoia, and the grubby quest for gold. My generation, you write, will be the last to live in a species-rich world, my generation will watch that world end. Has it already tipped? You know it so intimately. Is this done?
Well, I think our generation will be the last one to enter this forest as a wilderness, as a vast expanse of wildness. Now, I think we have a good chance of setting aside parks and reserves, but they are going to be finite, and they're not going to have the same immense dimension of what we see now, this continent-sized rainforest. I've got to admit, in the 30 years I've been working in Brazil, things have become a lot better. I started working during the military times when, to voice opposition to development schemes, these pharaonic development schemes like the Trans-Amazon Highway, could get you in jail. Now, with the resumption of democracy in Brazil, there are hundreds, thousands probably, of non-governmental organizations full of idealistic young people advocating the preservation, conservation of the tropical forest, advocating the rights of the Native Americans that live in those forests. And I've seen a sea change in opinion. This gives me the confidence to say that there'll be something left. There'll be something preserved, but it doesn't give me the confidence to say that it will be this continental size wilderness in which I live the adventure described in the book.
I've got to say, David Campbell, you put it in even more dramatic terms in the book, talking about the 4 billion year history of the Earth and this generation, this time as being the time of a tremendous die-off.
Yes.
I was kind of dumbstruck. I thought, well, all this effort has been put in here, and then you're writing, over the next several decades, Earth will lose hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of species. Most of this extinction will occur in the tropical forests, and especially Amazonia, in the course of a generation or two. The Amazon rainforest will be destroyed both as a wilderness and as a functioning ecosystem. Whew.
This puts an enormous burden on our generation. We live in a generation, a couple of centuries of terrible atrocities, monstrosities. But I think 1,000 years from now, when humanity looks back on this time, it will be most aggrieved by the fact that we let this panoply of diversity slip away. That can never be recovered. And the Amazon today is simply the most complex and biologically diverse community of plants and animals to have ever existed in the history of the planet, 3,500 million years of life. And it's there and it's today. And so we have this acute responsibility to do something about it, and not for short-term economic reasons or because of political reasons or nationalistic reasons, let it slip away. This problem we face really isn't in the political dialogue anymore, at least in the North. It certainly is in the political dialogue in the southern countries that have these forests.
When you get all the way upriver, you're confronted with kind of the nightmare. And I want to talk about the humans there, the people, how they're interacting with the river and the forest. But you end up in the midst of quite a fire at your camp. Of course, burning is the way that most of this forest goes down. I wonder if you could read for us, just so we have a sense of a very up close, almost too intimate sense of what the burning of that forest is like. There's a passage there. I wonder if you could share it with us.
Yes. Before I read it, I want to give a little preamble. This is the burning of a large area of forest, many thousands of hectares for a cattle ranch. There is slash and burn agriculture on a small familial scale, which probably doesn't perturb the biological diversity much at all. It hasn't for thousands of years. Mm. But when it becomes industrial, when it becomes when forest is burnt for the generation of beef and for the exportation of beef to the cities, then things become pernicious. Here's the passage. The smoke enveloping our camp has the stench of burning tires. A tropical forest is, of course, much more than mere wood and leaves. I am smelling boiling saps and latexes, uncountable fricasseed insects, tons of formic acid boiled from the bodies of trillions of ants, simmering lizards and snakes and venom. I am inhaling burnt frog mucus, doomed pollen, roasted nematodes, singed orchids, thrip wings, panic centipedes, worker termites baked in their earthen domiciles as they gather around their scented queen. I am steeped in denatured flavonoids, terpenes, alkaloids, proteins, all the wonderful stereochemicals crafted for insect antennae and mammal glands. able to trigger ovulation and alter moods, all torn apart, their language made dumb. I am bathed in burnt chlorophyll designed to capture the morning and bring it to earth, to intercept heaven's light and make it into food for all the small things. This is the immolation of Eden. Where do I retreat now? There is no more wilderness here, no wet garden. Do I take shelter in these puny words and the bright toxic screen of my laptop? Do I turn to dogma, to Santo Daime, take shelter in faith, invoke the names of saints? I doubt they've noticed. I suspect that the cold universe doesn't care about this little planet or her matricidal children. There must be a billion other living planets with better behaved offspring.
Her matricidal children. David Campbell reading from his new book, Land of Ghosts. And then a moment which I guess I understood, but there's a kind of redemption, but also kind of obscenity about it, where you walk into the middle of this fire, or it's still not raging, but where it's smoking, and you, with several whacks of an axe, take down a young tree that somehow has survived. Why take it down?
Well, our object was to record the distributions of the species of plants that occurred in a particular area. This tree had no chance of survival. It had no chance of finding anywhere to project its pollen to produce seeds with another tree. And yet, folded in paper as an herbarium specimen, at least there was a record of its existence. At least there was a record of the range of that particular organism. And so I performed an act of science, which in many ways was personally very disturbing. It was sort of the execution of one of the last remnant trees in this vast smoldering prairie that was going to be made in a vast smoldering cattle plantation.
Mm. An act of science, but also something very personal, almost mythic. You're right. I guess I wanted to put it out of its misery, the way one shoots a crippled horse. I don't want to curl up in my hammock tonight and imagine the tree standing alone, bereft of its kind. David Campbell, what about the human side of this? I was struck by how sympathetic you also are to the people who are making their home in the midst of this environment that's being destroyed. How do you have it both ways? Take us into your understanding of the people there.
Well, this story has all the trappings of a Greek tragedy. Heroic people, brilliant people, people who are generous, in one way or another contributing to the decline of this magnificent diversity. Now, as I said, the traditional way of making a living in this forest is small-scale slash-and-burn agriculture. This is often just a hectare or two, and the field is abandoned after a generation, perhaps, and allowed to regenerate its full bouquet of plants and animals. I don't think this kind of artisanal farming in the tropical forest has ever had much of a deleterious effect on the diversity. It's a way in which people have accommodated themselves to making a living in the forest and not destroying much.
But
it's only now with these large-scale industrial enterprises that the forest is succumbing in a way it can never recover from.
But you write about even those most intimately connected to the forest losing an awful lot of that connection, about
Native Americans
of this region who no longer have words for the diversity of this bio-effusion that they've lived with for eons. You say they did have words, they had a full vocabulary, and now that's drifting away.
I presume they did, Tom. When the first literate Europeans came to the Western Amazon, the Native American populations had already been decimated, and those few scraps that remained were submitted to slaving raids and evangelism. We think that probably in pre-Columbian times, the Amazon Valley had more people in it then than it does today, maybe several times more, that there were sophisticated polities along the river courses. There was tremendous transmutation of the forest into gardens that sustained people in the long term, and that all of this. And there were words in these indigenous languages for all of the species that occurred in the forest, and understandings of their uses, at least many of them. But by the time the first Europeans came, all of this had been lost, probably due to invisible waves of disease that spread down the escarpment of the Andes and later on to direct human predation on Native American slaving. So that when I first went to Brazil 30 years ago, I had the misconception that I was in a wilderness. I traveled for days sometimes along these river courses and didn't see a soul. And I thought, my heavens, this place has never been inhabited. But now I've learned to recognize the telltale pottery shards, the telltale black earths that the Native Americans have made that are good for agriculture. And I realize that I am in a land of ghosts, as the title of my book states, that I'm in a place that was once probably heavily inhabited, that once had languages in order to cope with the diversity, and now is empty and forlorn.
David Campbell is my guest tonight. His new book is Land of Ghosts. You can join our conversation. Can you imagine this engulfing green ocean of species? Can you imagine they may be gone in a generation? What are your feelings about the people struggling to survive on this frontier? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are taking a trip up the Amazon tonight, way up to the Earth's most species-abundant frontier, to witness its wonder and its destruction. My guest tonight, David Campbell. He's author of the new book, Land of Ghosts, professor of biology at Grinnell College in Iowa. You can join us tonight. Are you ready to concede that your generation, our generation, will be the last to live in a species-rich world? And what's the lesson that you're hearing from the upper Amazon? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. David Campbell, you fill your boats and bags with specimens from up the Amazon, but there's a big frame on your mind as well. You write you found yourself going back to Homer and to the journeys of his heroes through a kind of landscape around the Mediterranean in ancient times, classical times, that had been utterly changed from what it had been. What's the parallel you draw there when you look out across the upper Amazon?
Well, Homer described a Mediterranean with lions and wild goats, and we know that there were hippopotamuses, for example, in that part of the world. And today, if you travel to the Mediterranean, you find the shorn landscape of bitter herbs. All of the magnificent animals and vistas that were Homeric, that were described in those sagas, have been changed into mediocrity. And I think that's what's going to happen if we're not careful in this most splendid of wildernesses, Brazil. And that it's going to be there. There'll be patches around, but it's not going to have the same full panoply of species. It's not going to have the same magnificent 60-meter-tall vistas of forest that we see today.
Our own species is forging, you write, the next great earthly extinction, diminishing forever our only homeland, perhaps never before in Earth's history, barring extraterrestrial impacts, and we've had them. Have the events of a few decades been so important the changes being wrought in Amazonia will alter the trajectory of life on Earth? What do you mean by that?
Well, other writers, such as E.O. Wilson, have described this, that the extinction event that human beings are precipitating today is of the same order of magnitude as the one that caused the extinction of the dinosaurs 65 million years ago due to an extraterrestrial collision.
Into the Cretaceous era.
That's right. Mm. That's right. And this is the first extinction event of this kind of magnitude that's really been caused by one species going amok. And it's a sentient, an intelligent species. I would really hope that we could find a way to restrain ourselves.
Kathy's calling from Mebane, North Carolina. Hi, Kathy. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks a lot for taking my call.
Yeah.
As I listen to Dr. Campbell, myself, I've always had just an incredible awe of and watched every program I could watch on you know, the Amazon or things about Africa, and it's difficult not to get depressed hearing this kind of story. It seems so sad, and I mean it is sad. And I'm wondering, Are there other options for the peoples who live in these areas to make their living or take care of their families that don't involve this level of destruction? And if there are, or I guess maybe a second thought is,
yeah,
are there people out there with the influence to sort of stop the madness? How do we get people to care?
Great questions, Kathy. David Kimball, bring us completely up to date here. Where does this stand now? Is the pace of destruction growing, diminishing? Are there, as Kathy asks, articulated, clear alternatives for people here? Or are they still marching west from more densely populated Brazil? Can this be solved? Is there a plan?
No, that grand immigration scheme, I think, is pretty much over along the Trans-Amazon Highway. Since it was constructed in the 60s and 70s, parts of it have washed out, and its failure is now evident even to the most dreamy engineers. Mm. Kathy asks a good question, and it's one of the themes of the book. I think there are ways to utilize the forest and the river that do not decimate the diversity. One of the lessons of the Trans-Amazon Highway is that it necessarily, being a road, went over the uplands, the dry areas. In Portuguese, they're called terra firme forests. These are the very spots where the species richness is most abundant. And yet, this magnificent diversity of plants grows on soils that, for the most part, are, in the parlance of soil biologists, senile, bereft of nutrients, and therefore not conducive to long-term human agriculture or utilization.
And yet they've been used.
They've been used unsuccessfully. The people who were given grub stakes along the Trans-Amazon Highway in the 60s and 70s have now become environmental nomads, moving on. They're refugees trying to find a living somewhere else. But the local people, the Native Americans and these wonderful, generous hybrid folk called caboclos, know better. They live along the river margins. I described at the beginning of the program how the water rises and falls, in some places 15 meters, 45 feet. And as it rises, those waters that bear nutrients from the Andes, elements necessary for agriculture like magnesium and calcium and potassium and phosphorus, decant those sediments on the floodplain, in the forest and on the grasslands that surround the rivers. It's a freebie of fertilizer that comes in every year and leaves the soil enriched. It so happens that those annually enriched soils are not the places where the abundant diversity occurs. They are places that I think could be sacrificial for agriculture that sustains and builds people.
So target the zones of diversity more carefully than we have.
That's what. Stay away from colonizing the upland forest. That's where the diversity is, and people aren't going to make a good living there anyway. Mm. Encourage people to make a living by fishing or agriculture along the river courses. Mm. This is where they can make healthy livings.
Rick is calling from Elkhart Lake, Wisconsin. Hi, Rick. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. I'm Dr. Campbell. More of a comment and then maybe a response from you. I used to think of the people down that these are kind of unenlightened people in South America. They're destroying their own habitat. But then after a while, I began to think of what we have done in this country. I had heard somewhere that a squirrel used to be able to travel from the Atlantic Ocean to the Mississippi River from tree to tree without touching the ground. So now I no longer look down on them. I just wonder how we can. I'm hoping that they can be a little more enlightened than we've been in destroying much of our forest and habitat here.
Rick, we've got it. Thanks for your call, David Campbell. What are the odds?
Well, these people that I describe in my book, The Caboclos, are terribly enlightened. They're my teachers. I'm not their teachers. They know how to make a living in this riparian system, in this river system. And I think instead of looking at Western engineers and looking at Western scientists and the paradigms of massive pharaonic schemes that we have over the decades.
Pharaonic as in pharaoh scale.
That's right, as in building pyramids. That we should look toward the more artisanal and simple ways of making a living there that have always been going on there and learn from these humble, brilliant people.
Caboclos, define.
Well, they are genetically everybody. They're Native American, they're African, they're European. Even these days, there are a few Asians that contribute to the Caboclo line. But behaviorally, in terms of their traditions and ways of making a living in the forest, they're basically Native American. And they're independent folk that often live alone on a homestead dozens of miles from anybody else. But I've very seldom seen any protein deficiency, any hungry kids, anybody who's really suffering in Caboclo communities. They may be septic. They're certainly introduced diseases like malaria. But they're not wanting of nutrition and a good diet.
And these are not the big cattle ranchers, as you say, the industrial farmers that take it down mile after mile. But yet we read that thousands and thousands of square miles of this is still disappearing every year. Is that all from the industrialists, or is it from the small, you know, nibblers as well?
Well, the nibblers will continue to nibble, but they do it on such a small scale that the forest, in most cases, is able to recover. Mm. It's the vast expenses. In the 60s, multinational corporations like Volkswagen do Brasil and Armour Swift were given tremendous estates to develop for cattle ranching. They pushed the forest beyond the horizon. And the soils exhausted themselves. These are the same upland soils that have no capacity for long-term agriculture or, for that matter, being pastures in the long run. They were abandoned. It was a kind of mining of the forest to get a quick profit and then moving on. And today, the seeds can't find their way back. The propagules can't find their way back into these vast zones, and they become grasslands or lateritic pavement. Laterite is a kind of clay that dries as hard as a parking lot. Mm-hmm.
David Campbell, we've just got half a minute left here. We're so with you in that canoe when you're right about heading downstream, pushed by the big brown muscles of water. But that language of the dark inevitability of this being gone really haunts me. After all the years you've spent there, is that still the track we're on?
If we don't change our course, yes, I'm afraid so. But there are elements of a way out. Look to the Caboclos, look to the river folk, and follow their ages-old traditions, and I think we might find a way to preserve a decent amount of this magnificent biome.
Not what it was, but maybe not vanished either. David Campbell, we thank you for the journey upriver tonight. Thanks very much
thank
for being
you,
with
Tom.
Us. David Campbell, professor of biology at Grinnell College in Iowa, author of the new book Land of Ghosts, The Braided Lives of People and the Forest in Far Western Amazonia. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, the musical mystery of Birdsong. This is On Point. Philosopher and jazz musician David Rothenberg traveled the world to get at the heart of the mystery of birdsong. He wanted to understand the science and the aesthetic behind the song of the white-crested laughing thrush, the Albert's lyrebird, the green catbird. He even took his clarinet with him and played with him in a kind of cross-species meeting of musicians. Here, David Rothenberg explains how this musical collaboration began.
This whole project began when I was invited to Pittsburgh to play music in the National Aviary, which is one of the best collections of caged birds in America. And I had my clarinet out. It was early in the morning. I was wandering through the aviary playing, listening to all these birds, seeing what they would do. And all of a sudden, one bird in particular really responded to what I was playing in a surprising, in a different, in a really direct way. And that was a bird called the white-crested laughing thrush, native to Southeast Asia. And this bird really seemed to respond to what I was playing in an astonishing way, something I didn't really expect would happen.
Thank you.
I started to get this idea that birds with these longer, more complex songs, not all birds, but this kind of bird song, these birds have their own sense of aesthetic. They have their own kind of sound that they like. And I was a little surprised to find that same idea in Charles Darwin's The Descent of Man, which has at least two chapters just about birds. He says, look, birds have a natural aesthetic sense. They like beautiful things, beautiful feathers, beautiful songs, and that's why there's so much beauty in the world of birds. But then if you see where science went over the successive generations, the followers of Darwin were not comfortable with that idea. Didn't sound scientific enough to them. But I started to appreciate previously noisy, annoying sounds, sounds that I found kind of noisy and annoying, like the starling, which, as you all know, wherever you are in America, there's a lot of starlings. They make a huge racket all in the trees, whistling and screeching all together. It turns out they have one of the most complex and carefully structured bird songs that's been studied. And they just have their own aesthetic sense. They like noisy sounds, strange whistles, and it's all a real detailed structure. Hear a bird song, there's something really necessary about it. I mean, these songs have been sung as they are for millions of years, a lot longer than there have been people on this earth. So there's something about them that works in the whole scheme of evolution. And that in itself is awesome and impressive. I think in the direct sound itself, you know, you just hear this rhythm and energy and this real kind of driving force that's always there and keeps on going. And that's one of the things we found out when I went to Australia to play along with the Albert's lyrebird, a bird in the Queensland rainforests near Brisbane, Eastern Australia. This bird has one of the most complicated bird songs anyone has ever noticed or investigated. It takes this bird more than 5 years to learn to sing it. To make sense of birdsong, we've got to use all the human faculties we've got. You've got to use science, music, poetry, the experience of the naturalist, the writer, the traveler. Put all these ways of getting something out of birdsong together, and you get the largest human sense of this immediate part of nature. You start to listen to birdsong more closely, the natural world is going to seem a lot closer, and it will be harder to maintain a culture and a civilization that is intent on destroying nature and ignoring it and just letting it disappear while we just think about our own needs.
David Rothenberg is a philosopher and jazz musician. He's author of the new book, Why Birds Sing, A Journey into the Mystery of Birdsong. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.